We're talking about a rescue bill for the U.S. Postal Service and the latest on its operations ahead of November. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Attorneys general for more than 20 states, including Wisconsin, are suing the Trump administration over operational changes that may threaten mail delivery leading up to the November election. But wait, the Postmaster General announced yesterday that changes being made to the Postal Service would be suspended until after the election. Lots of developments. We will break it down, take your questions. How important is the post office to you? How satisfied are you with the services provided by the U.S. Postal Service and charges for package delivery? We're at 800-642-1234. Jacob Bogage is a business reporter for The Washington Post. Jacob, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me again.
All right, so we're not going to start with the announcement from the Postmaster General yesterday. We're going to get some context here. Starting with earlier this month, Post Office warns 46 states, including Wisconsin, that it couldn't guarantee timely delivery of mailed election ballots. So what is happening there? Why did officials feel they can't deliver on the ballots on time?
Yeah, this is a bit of an attitude change from years past for the Postal Service. So they would have these conversations with state officials in other, you know, for previous elections. But those conversations would be more along the lines of warnings and asking, how can we help, rather than saying, we're telling you what our service standards are. And if you can't conform to that, it's on you. And so this is the Postal Service, you know, making a statement that we can't help you here. These are our times. If you can't match up with our times, then you should change your laws. We can't divert more resources, or we can't prioritize your election mail over other mail or over other states. And with, you know, it's 46 states. That's all pretty much everybody. Yeah. So, that was an issue.
All right. So with this attitude change or a different approach, how have states reacted to this warning?
With litigation, with lawsuits. I mean, that's what we mentioned at the top. Right now, it's 21 states. I think more could even be joining, states attorneys general suing the Postal Service, hoping to force Postmaster General Louis DeJoy to take the force of law and apply it to his decision to suspend these operational changes. It's also not totally clear all the operational changes he's willing to suspend or that will stay in place. You know, we reported about mail machines being taken offline, 671 mail machines. Well, mail sorting machines. Well, 658 of those were scheduled to be taken offline before the month of August. They're already gone. So, you know, sure, he can say we're suspending some of these operational changes, but, you know, I've had a lot of sources tell me the damage has been done, and now we've really got to get a court to tell this guy no more. You really can't make any more changes.
Oh, so there were changes going on before, and now the question is, suspending is one thing, but will you go back and reverse course and put back those machines? And what you're probably anticipating is the answer is no.
Exactly. I mean, a lot of these times when machines are removed, and the Postal Service, we should be clear, removes machines for all kinds of reasons, good reasons, reasons that are well vetted, and we don't know that. I mean, I'm not saying that's not the case about these, but we don't really know it to be the case. When machines get removed, they get recycled. You know, they get disassembled. They get can they use parts for other machines for maintenance, or can they recycle those materials into other machinery or other, you know, metal items. There's a very good chance a lot of these machines are gone. And they're, you know, I don't know if you've seen them, and probably not because they're inside these distribution centers, but these are giant, hulking, massive things. When you take one of them out, it takes a long time to put it back in.
Mm.
So if it's gone, we can probably expect it to stay gone between now and November.
We're talking with Jacob Bogage, who is a business reporter at the Washington Post. We're learning the latest developments on the U.S. Postal Service and its embattled Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy. You can join in with your questions. What would you like to see, you know, the post office do at this point? Do you want it privatized, or is it an essential service that the government needs to maintain? Do you rely on the post office for your business or getting your medication? How important is it to you? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Jim in Freedom. Hi, Jim.
Hello. I've been talking to a lot of people about this, and most people agree with me that we should probably, in residential areas only, go to 2 days a week delivery, because the first thing I do at most of the mail I pick up is walk by my recycling bin and throw half of it away when I get home. The only two bills I get are my electric bill and some medical bills. That's it. And most of them have a 20-day grace period on them. We have cell phones and new ways of communicating. We don't need that mail truck going by our house every day. Just, I don't need a garbage truck pick my garbage up every day, and I don't need a mailman dropping by and dropping mail off my house. Just think of all the few we'd save just by not having these trucks run by our houses every day. And you could eliminate probably half your carriers, which would maybe make the retirement account that they have for the rest of them get balanced.
Jim, so, thanks. Jacob, has this been floated, reducing delivery down to a couple days a week?
It's definitely, reducing delivery days have definitely been floated. The Postal Service has studied going from 6-day delivery down to 5-day delivery. They've studied, you know, getting rid of Saturday delivery. I don't know that that could ever get through Congress, and not just because Democrats would be opposed to it, but because Republicans would be opposed to it. The Postal Service is an incredibly well-liked, beloved institution. People generally love the services it provides. Anytime you take those services away, that's really hard to get through Congress. And frankly, when you do take those services away, the people who are hit the most are folks in rural areas who may not have the same kind of access to private express carriers like FedEx or UPS or Amazon, who may not go out to those areas and may use the Postal Service to go out to those areas. Also, you know, I've been talking with lawmakers who say some of my constituents don't have broadband access. You know, some of these people don't have reliable internet connection the same way the rest of us do. You want to cut the Postal Service off to them? So I think that's why, yes, it would solve a lot of their financial problems. I also think it's a non-starter at this point.
And so it's looking to balance its books. It's trying to get out of debt. President Trump has been blocking more funding for the Postal Service. What argument is he making in withholding funds?
Well, he's made a couple different arguments. The first one was, I think, when I first joined your show a few months ago, was back when the pandemic really started hitting in March and April. President Trump in the Oval Office said he wouldn't approve a emergency coronavirus aid package to the Postal Service unless it quadrupled package prices. Again, that's a move that a lot of folks would worry about the future of the Postal Service if you did that, because a lot of these businesses that use the Postal Service to send packages would find it at that point a lot cheaper to use a private express carrier. So that's, and it would drive away very crucial business that's kind of keeping it afloat right now through the pandemic. So that's one. And then two was most recently the president talking about aid the Postal Service. He thinks it needs to facilitate mail-in balloting. And that's not totally correct, but that is also what kind of pushed this issue to the forefront. The fact that the Postal Service, the fact that the president thinks he can disenfranchise Americans and hobble their ability to cast their ballot in the November election by depriving them of essential services through the post office.
We have Washington Post business reporter Jacob Bogage breaking down the developments on the U.S. Postal Service and how lawmakers on Capitol Hill are responding to future changes. You can join in with your insights, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the financial and political challenges of the U.S. Postal Service here in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. U.S. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy announced yesterday he is suspending cost-cutting operational changes until after the November elections. This comes as attorneys general around the country, including Wisconsin, mount lawsuits this week over service changes that have prompted widespread reports of mail delays. And lawmakers on Capitol Hill want answers. How do you want Congress to intervene? What is the path forward for mail delivery in our country? It's 800-642-1234. Washington Post business reporter Jacob Bogage is our guide. Let's bring in Emily now in Prairie du Sac. Hi, Emily.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My opinion is that the Postal Service should definitely not be taking any... No funds to be taken away. I am on a medication that is only able to come to me via mail, and that's for my chronic myeloid leukemia, and I'm only 46. I've heard of a lot of, especially older adults, that receive their medications through the mail, and I think it is awful that they're taking money away from the post office right now for people like me.
Emily, thank you for sharing your situation. We also heard from John in Wheeler, couldn't stay on the line, but wanted to say this is really important to John, doesn't have a cell phone or email, relies on the mail for everything, medical, paychecks, everything. So as we're hearing that, you know, this is a lifeline, Jacob.
Yeah, it is. And when we talk about the Postal Service and the issues going on right now, it's really easy to slip into talking about vote by mail and ballots and election information. But there are a million reasons why we need a functioning postal service every day, and not just on November 3rd. It's Emily getting her medications. It's folks getting paychecks in the mail and bills. It's getting mail from your grandmother that, you know, I mean, like, there's so many reasons why, and so many important items that go through the mail, that limiting our concern about vote by mail to strictly November 3rd is problematic.
Louis DeJoy, who was named Postmaster General in June, he will be before Congress to testify on Friday and Monday. What are you watching for and listening for in these hearings?
Sure. So from Republicans, especially in the Senate hearing, I'm looking for a discussion on how much money the Postal Service really needs. And we're gonna roll up our sleeves and get into the weeds of the finances for a minute. The Postal Service has $15 billion in the bank, billion with a B. That's a ton of money for the Postal Service. And it's losing a lot less money per month than it expected to, because its package volumes are so high, because everyone's buying stuff online, because they don't want to go to the grocery store if they don't have to. They don't want to go to the shopping mall if they don't have to. So the Postal Service is actually, the numbers inside break down differently, but the top line numbers, it's doing about as well as it did last year, which is crazy considering the circumstances. So it's got that $15 billion. It's losing a lot less money. And then it's got a $10 billion loan from the Treasury Service to backstop it all. And then congressional Democrats are looking for more funding just in case something goes wrong, or to provide more vote by mail resources. So the upshot of that is the Postal Service does have a lot of money. It's not going to risk going bankrupt between now and November. But there's conversations about getting some additional aid. And I think that's what I'm looking for Republicans to try to drill down on and determine whether or not it truly needs that aid. From Democrats, I'm really looking for them to get into the relationship between the Postmaster General and the president, and how the Postmaster General came to decide or develop some of these policy changes that we've seen slow the mail down.
And what did DeJoy outline yesterday in his statement? Of course, it was suspending what he had planned to do, but what actions are not going through before November?
Yeah, so after the dust cleared, we're not really sure. There were a few things the Postmaster General explicitly said he would stop doing. And some of these, you know, predated him, but continued under his tenure. The first, you know, two are he wouldn't remove any more bulk mail sorting machines. That said, 650 some of those have already been removed out of 671 they were planning to remove. So that, you know, he doesn't really have any more to do. And he wouldn't remove or relocate any more public mailboxes, those blue, big, iconic collection boxes. We wouldn't take up any more of those. He also said he'd reinstate overtime hours. That's something that he had cracked down on and said we're not going to use overtime to deliver the mail anymore, and that was creating delays. What would basically happen is, in some communities, if your letter carrier or your mail clerk couldn't show up to work, your mail wouldn't go out because there was no one to replace them. And then he also said we will use extra trips to deliver the mail. They had a policy in place which was basically delivering today's mail tomorrow. And they said, we will stop that and we will use extra trips that we wouldn't have used previously to deliver the mail. There are a bunch of other changes that we're not sure if what he put out yesterday is a promise to rescind those as well. And we're not sure some of the stuff he had in progress, if he'll reinstate any of those, like the mailboxes, for example. Will they put mailboxes back in the locations where they removed them? We're not sure, and the Postal Service hasn't answered our questions about it.
Talking with Jacob Bogage, who's a business reporter for The Washington Post, we're getting up to speed on the U.S. Postal Service situation and the latest decisions from Postmaster General Louis DeJoy. Let's take another call now. Jim is joining us from Dubuque, Iowa this morning. Hi, Jim.
Hi. As far as the post office box, I think, you know, they've removed some like 14,000. It's been going on over a long period of time. It began in the last administration. A lot of these boxes are places where people put one or two pieces of mail in there over, you know, a day, and it's inefficient to have someone drive there and empty it. The main concern I have is not only the Postal Service delivering ballots. It's the accuracy of the voter registration rolls. For example, in L.A., you have 117% of the population getting a ballot. 117% of the people that ought to be able to get one, you know, they've got 17% more than that total number of people.
And so you're worried about the accuracy of those addresses and ensuring those ballots get to the right address. And that, too, is labor intensive, Jacob.
It is. I'll just say, you know, about the mailboxes quickly. Jim's right. When I asked the Postal Service about this, they said they remove boxes on a case by case basis based on low volume. But they didn't really elaborate on what kind of threshold they would consider to be low volume or worthy of removal. In terms of, so I still have questions about that, and I'll still keep, you know, reporting and trying to understand that. In terms of the voter rolls, you know, I am not a voting expert, but, you know, that's not, you know, I cover the Postal Service, but I can tell you from my reporting on Postal Service and vote by mail where those have collided. Yes, there are some jurisdictions where the voter rolls exceed the population. That's natural. That's frankly going to be most jurisdictions. Voter rolls are hard to, you know, are hard to keep up, and you clean them up, you know, every year before an election for folks who are deceased or folks who have moved away. But there is very little evidence, in fact, almost no evidence of fraud in vote-by-mail elections. I think there's a perception from a lot of folks that ballots go out, they get sent back in, and then you just count them. There's a rigorous verification process there. There's folks who check signatures, folks who check addresses, folks who check if ballots have come in from other jurisdictions. And it's a felony to submit a ballot that is not yours or in a jurisdiction where you don't live. And so these concerns we have about the accuracy of the vote, I think, are come from a good place, but may not be based on what we what we really should expect or what we've seen in previous elections.
Do you think this current crisis helped clarify any way support or opposition for the Postal Service with the public?
Absolutely. I mean, I think so the president in April calls the Postal Service a joke and says it wants it to increase its package prices, and immediately gets hit with a bunch of interest groups, television ads and radio ads all over the country saying, no, that's a bad idea. And the White House goes quiet on it. The White House, you know, the president on Wednesday night last week and Thursday last week says, oh, I'm going to hold funding from the Postal Service so it won't be able to do vote by mail, and gets absolutely slammed and gets his postmaster general hauled in front of Congress. And then we hear that Mark Meadows say, oh, no, the chief of staff say, oh, no, we'll take $10 billion. And then the president tweets, save the post office. I mean, I think he backed himself into a corner he really wasn't anticipating, and it illuminated very clearly American support for the Postal Service.
Jacob, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
Jacob Bogage is a business reporter for The Washington Post. He's reporting on the financial and political strains facing the U.S. Postal Service. Coming up, we hear from a UW-Madison athletics official about what the cancellation of the Big Ten fall sports season means for the university. That's after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just a heads up on our programming plans this week. Join us tonight at 8 for live NPR coverage of the Democratic National Convention from Milwaukee. It's a mix of virtual, some live events. We bring you up to speed and a recap tonight through tomorrow night starting at 8. That's here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we're discussing the postponement of Big Ten sports. There's pressure from football players who have signed petitions wanting to play, seeking answers on how or even if a vote happened last week among league officials. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is reporting that Big Ten officials are working on a football schedule that could have teams starting their season in early January. Do you agree or disagree with the decision to postpone the Big Ten season? Are you an athlete? How does this affect your college career and what comes after? We're at 800-642-1234. Chris McIntosh is UW-Madison Deputy Athletic Director, overseeing day-to-day operations of the athletic department, student-athlete recruitment, and strategic planning. Chris, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. Good morning to you.
Good morning. The Big Ten has 14 members, 14 schools. Kevin Warren is a commissioner. Players are asking questions about how the decision went down last week to postpone the season. They've signed petitions to play that we're seeing. Did a vote happen to postpone the season?
Yeah, a good question, Kate. You know, our players across the league disappointed with the decision that was made. It's a tremendous amount of preparation and work that goes into getting ready to play all of fall seasons, in particular football. And the decision that was made clearly wasn't one that was one they agreed with. And I think we all respect that, given the work that was put in. You know, our focus has been what's next. The chancellors and presidents of the Big Ten arrived at a decision based off of the concerns that they were presented with. And I think our go forward from here is to do everything we can to address the concerns that aren't limited to just playing sports in this COVID environment. There are common themes for sure throughout our society, but to address those concerns and to develop an alternative plan, which we've been busy working on since that decision has been made.
What does that plan look like, and how are you coordinating with other schools in the Big Ten? What is communication like?
Communication has been very thorough, and it has been throughout the process. The athletic directors meet every morning for 2 hours and have done so since March. And the communication from that body to the presidents has been very thorough, more so than it's ever been. And it's just needed to be that way because of the environment that we live in. Everyone knows, the information has been changing by the hour for, you know, extended period of time now. And So there's been more communication than ever. But, you know, I would just say this, we're in the development phase of developing our plan. It'd be premature to share too much about it right now. We're vetting different options, but I would say our focus is to provide fall seasons to our student athletes so that that preparation that they've put in and the expectation that they have to compete on a platform like the Big Ten can be delivered.
And there's talk of a football season to start in early January. Can you tell about the formations of this plan? What would that look like?
Well, I think it's one that could be exciting. Like I said, it's too early to share too much about it. There's a lot of work to be done. I think, you know, our coaches, in addition to or along with some of our athletic directors, including Barry Alvarez, have been busy, put their heads together and have advanced a concept that I think our student athletes will be excited about. I think our fans will be excited about. You know, that announcement is yet to be made, and there's work to be done before it can be.
Chris, let's talk about testing of student athletes for COVID. You know, athletes are back on campus. There have been voluntary training. Early in August, it was announced that, 21 student athletes had tested positive since summer workouts started in early June. What can you tell us about testing?
Our testing has been very thorough, though. You know, we face challenges like many do in obtaining those testings and continuing with those. There's just a strain on the supply chain of testing that isn't unique to athletics. Though we've been very fortunate over the summer to have a level of testing, availability of testing that's allowed us to test our athletes and staff that have contact with them weekly, every Wednesday. And it's gone very smooth. I think our student athletes have done a great job of doing everything they can to comply with the policy and the protocol that we put in place, both within our facilities and outside of our facilities on campus. They've got a vested interest in staying healthy and limiting the spread of COVID. And
How many tests do you usually administer on Wednesdays?
Each Wednesday, give or take, because of the voluntary nature of our workouts, approximately 200 to 250 a week.
And then you get those back. Have any come back positive in recent Wednesdays, I mean, recent weeks?
The recent weeks have been actually very encouraging in that we've had very few positive cases that have come back. You know, as many know, one of the challenges that makes participating in athletics difficult in this environment is the contact tracing aspect. You know, one positive case of COVID can result in tens or dozens of other people that need to quarantine for 14 days. And that's been a challenge that we've been presented with since we started doing our testing back on June 8th. It makes it very difficult for the rosters of each team to remain stable. It was one of the factors that presented a challenge to us for the fall season to continue, and it's one that we hope to be able to address if we're able to compete later on this winter.
We're talking with Chris McIntosh, Deputy Athletic Director for UW-Madison. We're looking at the Big Ten Conference postponing fall sports to next spring, what that means for the conference, what that means for players and fans. You can join in on your insights, your questions, 800-642-1234. Chris, you know, with this postponement comes the difficult financial situation that these athletic departments are in. What is the financial situation at UW-Madison when it comes to athletics? Will there be layoffs or furloughs when you're not playing any games?
Yeah, Kate, that's a great question. The short answer is, you know, we'll be faced with an extremely challenging financial picture. It's no secret that the opportunity that is provided to our over 800 student athletes in 23 sports is, you know, the cost associated with that is largely underwritten by the sport of football. We've benefited for a long time from being able to fill our stadium, and our teams, especially our football team, has been competitive and consistently competitive for a long time, and that has afforded us the ability to provide a best-in-class student-athlete experience to over 800 student-athletes. Without a football season, without the ability to fill our stadium on Saturdays, it presents a challenge. It's mitigated a little bit by the way that Coach Alvarez has, you know, we've managed our resources in a very conservative fashion. And so we've got the ability to use unrestricted gifts that have been made to our program to buy some time and to devise a plan. But it goes without saying that it will certainly affect our staff. I expect that there will be more furloughs. There's just no way around that. And, you know, our priority has been to preserve the level of support that we provide to our student athletes and to preserve the number of programs that we continue to provide here at UW, 23 sport programs.
I want to look at the petitions that are circulating among student athletes who disagree with the postponement and want to play. Are you seeing student athletes signing those petitions at UW-Madison and speaking out about the postponement?
We've had a lot of dialogue with our student athletes. In particular, Coach Chris has spent a lot of time talking to his football players. I'm not aware, I don't know for sure if our student athletes have signed the petitions. I wouldn't be surprised to learn that they have. I do know that there are a few that have been vocal about their frustration with the decision, and I think that's fair. I can actually share in that if I put myself back in my shoes as a player. It's hard for me to even imagine how frustrated or disappointed I would have been if I was going into my senior year and presented with this situation. So I haven't spent a lot of time scrolling through the petitions. I have spent a lot of time working with our coaches and our athletes here, talking to them about where we're at and where we're going. And it's clear, whether that's expressed through petitions or just in the conversations that we're having within our own ranks, that there's disappointment and there's frustration. And I think that's natural. I don't think it would be realistic to think that we wouldn't have been faced with that. It was a terribly difficult decision that the presidents and chancellors were presented with. I think they made a decision based upon the health and safety of our student athletes, which is our number one priority. And I think everyone, including the presidents and chancellors, is eager to get behind our next plan. And I think our student athletes will be excited about that.
Chris McIntosh is UW-Madison Deputy Athletic Director, talking about the historic move by the Big Ten Conference to suspend the season. What happens next for universities like UW-Madison? With your insights, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Chris McIntosh. He's UW-Madison's Deputy Athletic Director. The Big Ten Conference announced last week it was postponing all of the league's fall sports because of the ongoing COVID pandemic. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is reporting revised 2020 football schedule may mean a January start, but packing too many games into 2021 could be problematic. Taking your questions as well, 800-642-1234. Chris, across the pro sports landscape, there have been detailed plans made, thick guidebooks on how to resume play safely. NBA is in a bubble. How would you characterize where the Big Ten is at with developing such safety guidelines and plans to return to competition?
Yeah, that's a good question, Kate. There's been extensive work put against developing guidelines. Our doctors and sports medicine staff from each of the 14 Big Ten schools have put forth Big Ten guidelines. The commissioner has assembled a group, a task force of infectious disease experts, representatives from each of the 14 institutions that have put forth recommendations and guidelines, as has the Power Five, the Autonomy Five. I don't think that it's a lack of guidelines or protocol that has landed us in this position. I do think that there were some key or central issues and concerns that were presented to the conference and to the presidents and chancellors that couldn't be overcome. They felt couldn't be overcome at this moment, but I think there's hope that they will be able to be overcome in the future.
Let's bring in a call now. Ann is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Ann.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to add?
My question is, COVID has obviously created so many really devastating things, but it's also presented a lot of new opportunity. And I was curious if there have been new solutions, new ways of doing things that have come out as an unexpected outcome of everything.
Ann, thank you for that. Yeah, Chris, go ahead.
Yeah, I think it has. It's forced our department and our sport programs to adapt as the world has. It's not unique to us. I think, you know, from the business side or the back office side of our department, it's caused us to get leaner and more efficient. Obviously, like many, we've had to rely on technology in a way that we haven't had to before. But I do think in terms of our sport programs and our off-season conditioning that we have learned some things. I will say this just anecdotally, our athletes, especially our football players, have never been in better shape than they are right now. And they've never had the opportunity to train in just the limited to strength and conditioning like they have for as long as they have, basically since March. We didn't have spring football this past spring. I think, you know, that's got the attention of our coaches and might lead to a different type of offseason in the future that might be here for the long haul. And so that's one example that comes to mind, but there are certainly learnings that have come from this that will benefit us well into the future.
Are there risks with having athletes, hypothetically here, play a full season starting in January and then be back in August for training camp for 2021?
Yeah, there certainly are. You know, I don't think that it's realistic to have a full season in the, you know, in the first quarter of 2021 and then expect that our teams will play a full season in the third and fourth quarter of 2021. As a former player myself, the challenge, the wear and tear that would present would be unrealistic. And so I think that is one of the requirements or the principles that has been on the mind of our conference as we look towards this this new plan.
We're talking with Chris McIntosh, Deputy Athletic Director for UW-Madison, where he oversees day-to-day operations. We're talking about the circumstances with the Big Ten postponing the fall season. Taking your questions, your insights, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Sandy now, joining us from Mineral Point. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. I'm hoping that people can think a little bigger just than student athletics. This is only the second pandemic we've had, you know, in 100 years. It was only the first pandemic we've had since 100 years ago. And the decision to delay it might save somebody's life, whether they pass away or whether they are permanently affected if somebody gets infected. It's bigger than just college athletics.
Sandy, thank you. Chris, Sandy saying there, think bigger about the whole public health issue here.
Yeah, Sandy, it's a great point, and it's a humbling one. You know, it's consistent with what our communications have been to our student athletes and to our staff and to our fans since the second week of March. And that is, you know, our priorities from the beginning have been consistent. That has been, we want to keep our student athletes safe. We want to keep our coaches and our staff safe. And we understand the role that we play in public health. And we want to keep our fans safe. And to the extent that we play a role in the health of our community, that's our priority. So, you know, you're right. They're as difficult as it is sometimes for us to accept it. It's humbling to think, but there are bigger issues that are taking place right now in our world and in our country. And there is no one more passionate about athletics, college athletics, and the opportunity that affords the young people than us. But there are bigger issues at play right now. The health and safety of our student athletes is the priority. And I think our president's chances want to make sure that we're able to address those concerns.
So, Chris, logistically speaking, what are the expectations right now of student athletes whose season has been postponed? Are they working out? Are they reporting in? Are they not? How does that work?
Yeah, they have the option on a voluntary basis to continue to work out for the next couple of weeks before class begins. Many of our student athletes have taken this opportunity to go home to spend some time with their families before they come back and the fall semester begins. And once that begins, we will be in a mode of operation that's been, you know, relatively consistent with what we've been doing for the past month or so. They can train in a strength and conditioning fashion and do some instruction with their coaches for the foreseeable future.
As we start to wrap up here, what direction, what guidance are you seeking from Kevin Warren, the commissioner of the Big Ten? What insights do you need as a whole coming out of the Big Ten to inform the decisions you make at UW-Madison?
Yeah, great question, Kate. I think, you know, the direction that we need is maybe less from Kevin Warren at the Big Ten and more from the NCAA. You know, one of the overriding questions, and it's a great question that our student athletes have, is on the topic of eligibility going forward. And, you know, we need some guidance on that and some clarity on that. And I suspect that today's meeting of the council might begin to address that. And in the week or so ahead, that we'll have some clarity on that.
And when it comes to eligibility, how are athletes in a really difficult position right now?
Yeah, I think athletes are faced with certainly if you're going into your senior year, you know, you don't want to waste this season or miss this season. Though the uncertainty around whether the schedules will be stable or consistent causes folks to pause. And you know, as we sit right now, if a senior has the ability to redshirt this season, I think that's one of the choices that they're faced with. And if the NCAA can provide us with some clarity around going forward, what that might look like.
We'll have to be watching. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Chris McIntosh is Deputy Athletic Director for UW-Madison. Just ahead, we talk with a criminal justice professor about the prevalence and importance of recording police encounters and the impact it has on those who watch those videos. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.